Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Follow Your Path. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Eric Salazar. He is a transfusion medicine and coag specialist. He is currently in San Antonio, and today we will be talking to him. Starting off, Dr. Salazar, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you went to medical school and did your residency?
Sure, yes. Thank you, Abdul, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be a part of your podcast. I really enjoy listening to the many episodes. It's wonderful that you're doing this, and I think it's going to be a great resource for students and trainees. So a little bit about myself. So I'm from a town called Yancey, Texas, in South Texas. It's a small town of about 300 people, sort of southwest of San Antonio. I went to college at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, where I majored in music, actually, initially, and biology. I met my wife there. She's also a music major as a music teacher. And from there, I went to the Tri-Institutional MD-PhD program in New York City, which is a MD-PhD program combining Weill Cornell, Sloan Kettering, and Rockefeller. We were up there for a few years, and then moved back to Texas. I did clinical pathology residency at Houston Methodist Hospital in Houston, Texas, and then a transfusion medicine fellowship there also, and stayed on as faculty for a few years. And I'm currently at UT Health San Antonio in San Antonio, Texas. So kind of came full circle back to San Antonio.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's a wonderful tale. So when you were training for transfusion medicine and during your CP residency training, were there any particular mentors that inspired you, and how did you end up doing like coag particularly? Like, how did that come through?
That's a great question. There are many mentors that I had, especially during residency training, almost too many to list, and I almost hesitate to list them for fear of omitting someone, but I will mention several mentors. For coag especially, I learned a lot from Wayne Chandler, who was at the University of Washington for many years and then was at Houston Methodist for a few years. Just a real world-renowned coag expert, who was very selfless in sort of the time he would take to explain things. And was really, really good at distilling complex concepts into more simple concepts that were easy to understand. I've really tried to emulate his ability to do that, and not well sometimes. I really do my best to emulate him in that context, and certainly try to emulate him with respect to the expertise he had in coag. He's recently retired. And he leaves a big gap in the field. And at the same time, it's also wonderful to see so many coag experts also emerging, even amongst people of your generation. So he's one. There are many others, and for different things. Dr. Levesque was my transfusion medicine fellowship director, and I learned many, many things from him. Probably the most important thing that I learned from him is to always put the patient first. And in the same way that, in a similar way that Dr. Chandler was selfless in terms of his time and explaining difficult concepts, Dr. Levesque was selfless in terms of his time devoted to patients. And he would do anything for his patients. The patients always came first. It wasn't, the service per se. Like if there was some concerns about service logistics or you name it. Sometimes we put other priorities or competing priorities, and with him, the patient was always first, and that's the way to be. And so I really learned that from him. Dr. Musser, James Musser, is the chair of the Department of Pathology and Genomic Medicine, and I learned too many things from him to even list, but just a few. And it's difficult for me to even put it in words, but he's such a fantastic scientist and such an amazing writer, and so skilled at, again, distilling complex research concepts into understandable, especially words on paper. Also, independent from that, he's really, really good with the media. And like, you know, if he's being interviewed, like in this context, he is just the master at all of this. So I really have tried to emulate him as much as possible, and not that well, again, but I really do my best to emulate him. There are many, many, many others. Mary Schwartz is the head of anatomic pathology, just another fantastic pathologist that puts the patient above all else. And and if that means, you know, staying really late or working really extremely hard, she, you know, she does. I really try to emulate her. Dr. Powell, Suzanne Powell, is a really devoted residency program director, similar situation. And I've also found folks like that here in San Antonio, like Leslie Grebon, Russell Higgins, who's just a fantastic COAG expert. And not just COAG, I mean, all things hematopathology. And Dr. Kinney is our chair here, who's, you know, really puts her pathology department members above all else also. And it's really wonderful to see how she does it. And there are mentors independent from where I've trained or where I work also, from other, let's say, organizations like CAP or AABB. Like you might be on a committee with someone and they might have a particular skill set or a way of interacting or independent from skill set, like particular expertise in a certain area. And they serve as mentors for me directly or indirectly. Sometimes I acquire mentorship by observing and trying to emulate. So, and there are many, 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 many examples of folks like that across the different professional organizations. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, definitely. So, my next question was going to be, if you had to talk to a medical student or a resident who just joined, his or her residency program, and you had to tell them about COAG, like what makes COAG so special? What is so unique about COAG? Why should anyone, do COAG?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a really great, great question. So there's a few reasons to do COAG, a few reasons that I love COAG. One is that in COAG, you still get to see patients. So it is not uncommon for us to conduct an extensive interview with a patient that is suspected of having a bleeding or clotting diathesis. Right, some kind of bleeding or clotting disorder. And, you know, we conduct extensive interviews, physical exam, and then decide on what kind of tests we want to do to make a more definitive diagnosis than that patient may have had. Second reason, so you get to impact patients on an individual level. Mm-hmm. Second reason is that being the director, a medical director in a coagulation lab, you get to impact patients across the whole healthcare system by bringing on particular tests that might be necessary for appropriate patient care or changing the tests that are already available in some way. And also, of course, ensuring the safety of the tests. And this is a big deal because let's say that a new anticoagulant has emerged on the market and there's not a great way to test it. If you can bring on a test that can detect that anticoagulant, you can have a huge impact on patient care, and not just one patient at a time, but many, many, many patients. Mm-hmm. So, so you get to impact patient care on an individual level and on a broad system level. And I love COAG for that reason. Third reason, not that many people know COAG. and honestly, even amongst experts, if I can claim to be one, many of us will admit, like, there are things about COAG that we don't completely understand yet. So it ends up being a real niche. Like, there's a lot of people that are actually afraid of COAG. So if you know COAG to a decent extent, you're valuable to patient care. You're valuable to the healthcare system. You're valuable to your hospital, your department. And that's another reason. So I mentioned that I was a music major in college, and one thing I played as a musician was a bass. I was a bass player. I played other things, but I was a bass player. And the bass player is kind of like, you know, usually sits in the back of the band, doesn't get all the glory, you know, the, I don't know, lead guitarist or saxophonist or somebody like that's taking all the solo, or the singer, right? And I can think of COAG or Pathology a little bit like that. Like, you're sort of like making sure that everything is safe. The other people don't know how to do what you're doing, but you've got your niche and you're valuable because of that.
Yeah, that is, I love the analogy, the music analogy. I love it. Like, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. So can you share a case with us, like an interesting case in COAG that has stayed on with you throughout these years that you cannot forget and that has almost impacted you as a clinician as well?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. There's been a few cases. So if it's okay, I might describe.
Yeah, sure.
Two, maybe.
Yeah.
One was an elderly gentleman that for 3 years had excessive GI bleeding, and they could not figure out why. He had been scoped, you know, many times, endoscopy and colonoscopy many times, and they could not find a reason for his bleeding. And he would bleed to the extent that he'd have to be admitted, have blood transfusions, and, you know, he had a difficult life because of that. And he came to, this was when I was in Houston, he came to our healthcare system and saw one of our hematologists who ran, obviously, a big battery of tests. And one thing that we noticed was that his von Willebrand levels were not what one would expect for someone without a history of von Willebrand disease. And if you know, there's different types of von Willebrand disease, and the more common one is type 1. Well, his labs were showing type 2 von Willebrand disease, which suggests not necessarily that the amount of von Willebrand that he has is abnormal, but that the function of the von Willebrand factor is abnormal. And so he had, you know, a type 2 von Willebrand disease, but prior to 3 years ago, had never had any excessive bleeding. The guy had been through, you know, different surgeries, knee surgery, he had an appendectomy. You know, he played sports. He didn't have any excessive bruising or bleeding since childhood. So this is something more recent. So in terms of thinking about whether something is inherited or acquired, it seemed pretty clear to us that this was something that he had acquired.
Right.
And then when we tried to determine whether he could potentially have an autoimmune condition causing this, we ran a test called a serum protein electrophoresis, and we saw that he had a monoclonal antibody present. And our thinking was that this patient had developed sort of an autoimmune condition that caused him to develop acquired von Willebrand disease. Kind of rare.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had made actually an antibody against von Willebrand factor that was binding to the von Willebrand factor and actually consuming the von Willebrand factor to the extent that it looked like he had von Willebrand disease. And sort of the best test for this was to give him von Willebrand, like a source of von Willebrand, and then over time, see how quickly he got rid of it. And he, when we gave him a dose, and the hematologist was kind of like, I don't know how much to give him, you figure it out, and you know, you do. So, you know, we were calculating how much, you know, of the drug to give him. It's called Humate-P, how much Humate-P to give him. And we were deciding on when to test him, over what time period. And this is another situation where I reached out to different mentors and asked, what have you done in this scenario? And they all gave me advice. And so we did that. We gave him a bolus of von Willebrand factor and then measured how quickly he got rid of it. He got rid of it very quickly. And we gave him that bolus of Humate-P and his von Willebrand level dropped within about an hour and a half or so.
Wow.
But below half levels, which is a half-life very quick. It suggested, again, that he was clearing his von Willebrand very quickly from this antibody. Discussed with the hematologist extensively, and they decided to put him on immunosuppression. So he got steroids, prednisone, and rituximab. And within a period of about 2 to 3 weeks, his von Willebrand levels completely normalized. He stopped bleeding. And basically, he lived happily ever after. He didn't have any recurrence, as far as I know. And he's been doing really, really well. So it was a One of these scenarios where you're impacting patient care on an individual level. And so that case is, there was another case that I think is worth bringing up in this context because demonstrates again this niche of co-ed. So you might recall in 2017, the Houston Astros won the World Series. And I can share this because it's all in, it was in the media.
Right.
This case, not that the Astros won, but the case. So during the parade, you might remember after the World Series that there's a parade. And
I was actually in downtown Houston while that parade was happening. I wasn't part of it, but I saw what was happening.
So there's a parade, and one of the coaches was on the float, and during the parade float, and he slipped and fell off the float. And he slipped and fell, and he actually had some head trauma. Well, he was rushed to Houston Methodist and started to receive urgent intervention because it turns out that he had enough head trauma to cause bleeding. It also turns out that he was taking an anticoagulant called rivaroxaban. Mm-hmm. The trade name was Xarelto. And at the time, Dr. Chandler and others had helped set up some testing to detect the presence of this drug. And I remember this was like a Saturday night, something like that. I got woken up and the OR was calling, the neurosurgeons and anesthesiologists were calling saying, you know, this guy's got a brain bleed and he's on Xarelto. What can we do to reverse the anticoagulant? And I gave them some advice, you know, the approach that we could take and what labs we could measure and, you know, how can we, you know, approach the case in general. And they took the advice and he did well, probably perhaps more because of the skill of the surgeon, but perhaps also because of what we gave him that night. This is before there were reversal agents available, et cetera. And he did well, but the case sticks with me because as I mentioned before, you know, if you learn a particular fund of knowledge in a niche like COAG or whatever it is, I mean, it could be another niche, you know, cytology, a niche in cytology or search path or a particular surgical pathology organ like, you know, prostate or breast, that you can really impact patient care. You can really add value to your hospital department, you know, healthcare system, et cetera. So those are two cases that stick out to me that I remember. And I'm sure there are many others. Those are two that really stick out.
Those are really
clear memories on.
Nice. So, I believe you have probably mentioned it within our conversation, but what do you find is the most gratifying aspect of your job? What makes you happy doing your job?
There's a few things, actually. First of all, I really love my job. I mean, I think clinical pathology is just, I'm really, really fortunate to have found this field. I don't think that early on in medical school, you get like great exposure to it. And I'm glad that I did when I did, so that I could make this decision to go into this field. But there's a few things. One is and as I mentioned, patient care impact on an individual level versus a system level. I really like that. Third thing that I really like is quality improvement. So this is a little bit maybe more like almost maybe like a little bit more like maybe the way engineers probably think or think about their job. I don't know, but you're trying to find sort of systemic faults in our policies, procedures, approaches, et cetera, that lead to events, and you try to implement policies, procedures, practices, et cetera, to prevent those events from happening again. And I really love to do that. Like, I don't know, let's say that you had a quality control failure and, you know, you're trying to investigate why did that quality control failure happen? How can you prevent it from happening again? Or if you were out on proficiency testing, you know, what was the reason for that? Or if there was, some kind of event that led to a blood product, you know, being released in a less than ideal fashion. How do you prevent that from happening again? And in a sustainable, repetitive way that makes it high fidelity and safer. I really love to do that. I think it's a lot of fun. and a very gratifying, and it's also really important for us to do it for patient safety.
Yeah, wonderful. So for if a resident is interested in pursuing a career in coagulation, what route can they choose? What are the fellowships that are available, and are there any particular exams that they have to take after?
Yeah, so coag is one of those fields that doesn't have widespread availability of dedicated fellowships just for coag. Usually people that oversee the coagulation lab come from two directions. One is from transfusion medicine. So you might be trained in transfusion medicine and you cover coag. The other is hematopathology. So maybe you were trained in hematopathology and you're the hemopath department is responsible for the coagulation lab. So there's sort of two approaches, and you'll see that, for example, on the CAP hemostasis and thrombosis committee, there's hemopath sort of folks and transfusion medicine folks. There's some that do both hemopath and transfusion. And so you can approach it from both directions. For medical students that might be interested in it, of course, this is a sort of a field in pathology. Mm-hmm. So definitely think about pathology. And of course, in pathology is anatomic pathology and clinical pathology. Coag is, of course, more clinical pathology oriented. And if you're serious about considering that field, definitely find a mentor, definitely find someone that's practicing coag, and ask them a lot of questions. And definitely think about where you're gonna train, where you're gonna go into residency. Is coag something that they offer as a separate rotation? Is there a dedicated coag director? Sometimes there's not. And if you're serious about going into coag, you wanna find a place like that.
Okay. And my last question, and then it's sort of like a continuation of the one that we just talked about. So if residents want to know more about coag, like what advice, number one, would you have for residents who may be interested in coag, and what resources would you suggest they can find if they're interested in learning more about coag?
Yes, that's a great question. There are a few ways to learn more about coag. The main way, for residents specifically, the main way is to speak to the person that covers coag at your institution. Let them, if you're interested, let them know that you're interested. I'm sure they would look upon that, you know, favorably, and in a way that they would get you involved in different projects. There's always projects, whether you're validating an assay or an instrument, you know, answering questions from clinicians. Sometimes mentorship can simply take the form of being CC'd on an email, where you get to read how a particular expert is responding to different questions. So I would definitely do that. Second is, there are lots of really great meetings that you can learn coag from. And there's a spectrum, of course, right, in terms of like how much you can learn. So one way to approach this is from the transfusion medicine perspective, like attending AABB. AABB is going to have a lot of coag content just because it's a transfusion-oriented field. And attending AABB, I think, would be really good for you as a trainee regardless, especially if you're interested in CP or transfusion medicine, but also for coag. CAP, the College of American Pathologists, that's another great meeting where there's always coag topics. And publications from CAP often have coag topics also, like CAP Today. They seem to have coag on a very regular basis. And I really like that. So you can read CAP Today with some regularity, and you will be exposed to coag for sure. And now getting into more, so along that spectrum, like even more coag. ASH is a meeting that's usually dedicated to hematologists, but has a lot of coag content, a lot of very clinically oriented coag content, like, I don't know, trials of anticoagulants, these kinds of things. Even more along that spectrum, ISTH. ISTH is the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis,
right,
which is all coag. Like, it's, you know, it's a bit of drinking from a fire hose approach to even for experts. Like it's a right. But it's really a great organization, and the meetings are often international, really there's some world experts in COAG that go to that meeting. In North America specifically, there's something called BISNA, Thrombosis and Hemostasis Society of North America. You can get involved in that. That's more like sort of a North America. Finally, if you really are interested, you should apply to become a junior member of the CAP Thrombosis and Hemostasis Committee. There's always a junior member, usually two.
Yeah.
And if you are very interested, you should apply. And that would be a great opportunity to learn COAG, because often what the committee is dealing with are, problems in the COAG world, whether it's like blue top tube shortages or shortages of some other testing platform, problems with particular testing approaches, questions from the broad community about COAG. The committee answers all those questions, and it's a great way to learn more by learning from the members of the committee and how they approach these kinds of problems.
Oh, wow, wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Salazar. That's our show for today. And it was great talking to you. And please, viewers and listeners, if you like our show, please like, comment, and subscribe. And we'll be back with another episode soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Special thank you to our listeners. Until next time, enjoy an excerpt from an upcoming interview with Dr. John Hart.
I really like all pathologists, we all like that puzzle of figuring out the diagnosis, and it just really fits very nicely for medical liver in particular. You know, with tumors, you throw on some stains, you know, you do nowadays molecular, and the diagnosis becomes evident. But for medical liver, you really have to kind of dig. You have to consider, you have to think about the pattern, and then correlate the clinical information, the laboratory results, talk to your hepatologist, consider the alternatives, and then hopefully get down, if you don't get to a specific diagnosis, at least get to a diagnosis that helps patient management, which is really cool. I love that. And I love that our hepatologists come to our scope. It's really important for our fellowship training. The fellows are there, we're there. You know, we talk about the case first, but when the clinician comes, then that real action starts, because you can see how what you say affects the patient's management. If we call it this, they'll do that. If we call it something else, or if we give a less specific range of diagnoses than what happens in that arena. So I really love that